So welcome everybody to this week's Football Fans Podcast. This is the ultimate and only pod that gives the football fans, the real fans, a voice on all the issues of the sport that we are obsessed with. We love the sport.
I'm putting Allardyce in there, I'm putting Pulis. And the first thing they say when you ask them a question about how well Leicester's done is, oh, well, Pearson set the foundations, all Ranieri had to do was come in.
People that say, oh yeah, give you the chance. They only want youth to have a chance when it's English youth.
It would be foolish to think that there will not be people that won't go to France because of what's happened. There will be people that won't attend, and there will be people that you would offer your two tickets to that would turn it down. And I don't think you can think anything less of those people, because it is kind of scary right now.
My name is Jordan, I'm your host. And just to give you a reminder that everybody can follow us on Twitter, those are on Twitter, FFP_11. And also you can subscribe to us via the iTunes Library Football Fans Podcast. Now that I've got that out of the way, let's introduce this week's panel. Star-studded panel it is. We have our Chelsea supporter, Gabriel. How are you doing, sir?
I'm really good. We won. We're staying up, so life is
You're
good.
Staying up. Oh, staying up.
So yeah, we are staying up.
We have Natasha, our Arsenal fan, back after a few weeks off. How are you doing, my dear?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
I'm very well, very, very well. And we also have our Liverpool fan making his second appearance on the pod. Stephen, how are you doing, my friend?
A good weekend to be here.
Similar to G.
Back to talk about title aspirations and all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Oh, give it a rest.
Okay, let's take it one game at a time, yeah?
Wow. I like it. All right. I want to start with you, G. Quick question. Have you seen a better 35 minutes of football this season than what Liverpool produced on Saturday?
Why do you have to come to me, Jordan?
You know I'm coming to you.
They were really good, and it pains me to say it, but they were really, really good. This season, no, I haven't. It was really impressive. Like the intensity, I like the link up between Firmino and Coutinho. Yeah, everything about it was a really positive performance, unfortunately.
What stuck out for you, Stephen, as the main things that were so... Because I haven't seen, I mean, even when we... Arsenal humiliated United 3-0 the Emirates over the season, we humiliated them, but there was something just more. There was techers going on that first 35 minutes from you guys.
Yeah, it looks like everyone's bought into the ideas. They're bought into the shape he wants to play. I think the interesting thing is what he's going to do with strikers for the season. So Benteke clearly was fit, brought him on, had Sturridge on the bench, could have brought him on for 20 minutes giving him a run out, but he's decided to go with Firmino, and it might be a sign of things to come for the rest of the season. The way he wants to play, he's going to want strikers that press from the front, they're all action, they're all energy, and have technique when they've got the ball. I'm not sure when Benteke came on, he got a ball, got put clean through. He had to stop up and back someone off before he got himself going again. So I thought that was the most interesting, along with playing well, I thought the most interesting thing was the forward structure that he came up with, whether that's something he's going to go with for the rest of the season.
Okay, I'm sticking with you, Stephen. Does Arsenal's season live and die by the return of Coquelin / signing a DM in the January window?
No doubt. I mean, it's unbelievable that Arsenal are still in this position 5 years down the line, still talking about DMs being the be-all and end-all of their season. If you're going to go into the season with Coquelin as your only man to play that position, you run the risk of this happening. And I thought Arteta coming on was... laughably bad for that kind of half an hour he managed to stay on the pitch. I think January can't come round quick enough for Arsenal and see what they can get in. It's worth breaking the bank and breaking the wage structure.
Natasha, the next few games, they've got some inverted commas nice games: Arsenal, Norwich, Villa, Sunderland, and then they've got City in I think the week before Christmas. Has Coquelin become Arsenal's most important player in the whole squad?
No, I disagree with Stephen. Don't get me wrong, I agree in the sense that we shouldn't have just been relying on him. My thing wasn't so much if he gets injured. I was expecting him to get banned by now, get his 5 yellow. Yeah. Like, don't get me wrong, I love the fact that
still
he's...
still might happen.
Yeah. I love the fact that he's an all-in kind of player, and you see him shouting at others, especially people that are older than him. So I agree in the sense that we should have supported or got someone else in that role in the summer. But I feel as if Cazorla being off the ball for me is a bigger issue than Coquelin. Because the thing with Arsenal is, you always kind of think, even Marvin said as a Man U fan, Arsenal always score goals. But this weekend, we didn't look like scoring. And that's the second, obviously, because Ola came off sick a couple of weeks ago. That's the second weekend he's not been the Santi that we know and love. And I think his form is more crucial than Francis Coquelin's injury.
I just think he needs someone there with it. Cazorla's like a magic player. He'd get into most other Premier League sides, no doubt about it. But he's not going to do that dirty job of breaking
I know,
play.
But the thing with Arsenal is, when you've got players like him, there's always... It's that Kevin Keegan thing of, we're just scoring more goals than the opposition. So if I've got an on-form Cazorla and on-form Alexis, I'm not worried about nothing. Whether or not Francis Coquelin's in the team or not, yeah, we'll probably concede, but we've got checking goal... And we're going to score goals. So 9 times out of 10, we're going to score more than the opposition. Or we're going to score at least one. Even if it's 1-0 to the Arsenal, I don't care. 3 points is 3 points.
Yeah, you take that. I don't know. That hasn't worked for the last 3 or 4 years, though, with like fancy players in midfield.
For the last 8-9 years.
Yeah. All right, G. moving on. Natasha, should United go out and spend 50 mil on Ronaldo next summer?
50?
Well, I don't think
add another zero to that.
I don't think they're gonna. He's worth 16 personally. So I think 50 mil. They're probably that's what Real would probably want for him.
It depends why they're buying him. I mean, Man U's kind of transfer structure since Van Gaal, even since David Moyes, has kind of just been like. You know, I don't know, when you got Christmas money as a kid and you just went to the shop or your nan gave you a pound instead of the 50p and you just went mad and bought all the sweets and made yourself sick after, that's kind of been their transfer way of buying players.
Yeah, absolutely.
So if you're going out to buy Ronaldo because you're thinking, right, we can play him here in the team, he can line up against this with this system, 4-3-3 or whatever, great. If you're buying him because he's Ronaldo and the fans like him and you're worried that the fans are already doubting Van Gaal, then no, that's the wrong reason. Because Ronaldo's the sort of player, if he's not happy, he will still do his best because he's still a class player. Or as Merce would say, top class player. But if he's not happy, you don't want that kind of personality in your dressing room. So it depends for me. If you're buying him for football, purely football, on the pitch reasons, yeah, go get him. If you're not, then nah. Why? Go and get Bale, if that's the case. If you're buying someone for marquee signing, go and get Bale because his attitude will be better when times are hard. Mm.
Okay, all right, nice one, guys. So let's get into it now. We've not actually spoken any real depth this season on the pod about Manchester City. We've spoken about Arsenal, Tottenham a few weeks ago. We've done Sunderland, Villa, Chelsea quite a few weeks,
yeah,
and Liverpool as well. We've not done City. I think on the first pod we talked about Silva and Yaya after their game against West Brom and how impressive they were. But let's talk a little bit about City now. And I want to ask the question, which is baffling to me, and I'm hoping you guys can help me answer this question, is start with you, G. Why are Manchester City title favourites?
Well, first time, I think I was on the second or third week, and I said City were my title favourites, and this is before we had kind of crashed and burned over the season. And to be honest, they have been my favourites for the last 3 or 4 years because I think they have the best squad, they have the best team. The only thing what I'd say, where I would never say they'll definitely win the league or they should win, I say they should win the league rather than they will win the league, is because whereas they've got the best squad and the best team, I think they've probably got the third or fourth best manager. And I think that probably holds them back slightly. But if you look at it, I think last season they had the best squad by a little way as well. And they added to that squad Kevin De Bruyne, Sterling. Yaya seems to not be as annoyed as he was with things last season. You look down their squad and it's difficult to see any weaknesses. So that's where I'd say they'll
be favourites.
I don't
know, we found a few on Saturday.
No company, no silver.
Well, this is my point.
But that's the strength and depth thing then, ain't it?
Exactly. Everyone says they're the title favourites because, as you've said there, they've got the best and biggest squad. You take out company, silver, from that team and they're getting humiliated at home. And it's not the first time they've been battered at home this season. Let's not forget that. And battered at all. Tottenham went... smashed them.
And
West Ham beat them 3-1 as well. So if you've got the best and biggest team, the idea of that then is if company falls out, because you've got the biggest squad and the best squad, your replacement should be of somewhere near equal value. It clearly isn't. So I'm thinking, why are they the title favourites? on the basis that they have the best squad. If we saw on the weekend that their
that's
squad
because statistically
isn't the, best.
The cream rises to the top. They're title favourites because they've got the most expensive squad, they've got the most expensive individuals. To me, they don't have the best team. They have the best individuals, but that doesn't necessarily equal the best team.
I agree. That's the best team for you. In terms of winning the league.
I don't know. I want to say Arsenal, but then I'm looking at United and they're keeping clean sheets. So you have to say as a team performance, if they can get their goals, because now the defence is working. And that was their big issue the other season. So now the defence is working. If they can start picking up goals, that's 3 points every week.
But that's the thing now, because you're saying that City are title favourites, but should United not be the title favourites? They haven't got the best or biggest squad.
No, because...
But they're getting results.
Normally, at the end of the season, it's the whole cream rises to the top. And when you... This is why QPR were always in trouble, because they had like the 8th highest wage bill, but they were finishing in 18th. So normally, when it comes to the end of the season, where you finish is where your wage bill is. You know, Liverpool have always kind of been around 6th, 7th. Arsenal have always been in that top 5. So when you look at it that way, like if we're going on past seasons, but we all know that a bad injury for one player can completely derail a season. Look at Eduardo at Arsenal. When he busted his leg against Birmingham, their heads went. You know?
Yeah, but Stephen, on Natasha's point there that a key player out can derail a season, when you're spending 30 million on Mangala, 30 million on Otamendi as backup to Company, is that acceptable?
That's where I think City's problems have come from. When you look at, they've spent big money, so they're spending big wages. So statistically, they should finish top, should finish second. But when you look at the way Mangala played on Saturday night, that's not a £35 million centre-back. He might grow into a £35 million centre-back.
2 years in now.
But Di Michaelis was the same. His first season, I was like, who is this guy pretending to be a professional footballer? Like, he was competing with Titus Bramble for nicking a living. He was. And then he come back after Christmas and suddenly was a different player. And I do think sometimes people underrate.
The difference is, Michaelis was an established player and he came good after a year and he didn't come in with a £35 million
price
tag.
He was an older player, so you would expect him to come in and find it easier than, say, the younger crop. I think for defenders, the Premier League is probably harder than it is for strikers, because for the defenders, you've got people like Christian Benteke and Diego Costa who don't give an F, who will kick you just as hard as you kick them. And I think a lot of defenders struggle to deal with that, and therefore they take time to show their real quality. I'm not saying these players are better than Company. I'm just saying, you know,
and some of City's transfer dealings have been questioned. Not take out the 35 millions on Mangala that haven't quite worked out. Selling Dzeko, it's clearly a mistake now when you're bringing on Ignacio to replace Aguero after an hour.
Boney's injured though. In fairness,
these are the things that happen in a squad. So if you've spent £500 million over
three seasons,
decent
strikers.
The kid looks like he's got a bit of talent. There's no doubt.
He's 18 and he shouldn't be having that.
But that's
pressure.
The thing. He's coming on with a half an hour left, and they're going save a game at home to Liverpool when we're 3-1 down. So I think they've had problems both overspending for players on players coming in to be squad players, and getting rid of players that maybe they should have kept hold of when you look back at it now.
But you say about, because people talk a lot about giving young players a chance. So they've got Aguero, they've got Boney. Shouldn't their third, because didn't they pay one man up front, shouldn't their third choice striker be a youngster? Because otherwise, how would Iheanacho ever get a chance?
But I think that works. Liverpool can get away with that story. Yeah. Spurs can probably get away with that story. I'm not sure Man City with Arab oil money gets away with having an 18-year-old as their third choice striker. Yeah. Knowing Aguero's injury problems as well, it's almost unforgivable.
And I also think people that say, oh yeah, give youth the chance, they only want youth to have a chance when it's English youth. I think when they see Spanish kids, they're like, oh, Arsenal have got no English kids in their academy. But a lot of these kids have been here since they were 12, 13, you know.
Yeah, well, Fabregas qualified for England under the home rule thing.
He's more Cockney than any of us sat in this room, do you know what I mean? With his little Spanish tilt. But so what I'm saying is, if you're English, yes, give youth a chance. But if you're not, and it doesn't benefit your national team, then suddenly you don't want youth to be playing for you.
And I think some of the other side, again, it's going back to signings for me with City, with their squad. Fabian Delph, obviously to keep up their quota of English players. No disrespect to Delph. He's a very decent Premier League player. He is not going to win you a league title. If I was a Man City fan, that's not a signing that inspires me. If when I see us spending money on him in the season, if I was a City fan, I mean, he took a shot from 40 yards left footed against Liverpool the weekend.
It was
a really inept display. He got overrun in the middle of the park. He's just not quite at the, Liverpool's midfield is better than Fabian Delph. He would probably struggle to get in our midfield. So therefore, with the money City have spent, he's not good enough to play in their midfield.
With the money that City are spending, is it acceptable? I just find it. I mean, Ollie made a point on a few pods back when we referred to City about how they've not won a league as easily as they should have. They've won two leagues in the last 4 years, but both one of them was with the last kick of the season.
Stole the two of them.
And the second one was the last week or the last day of the season as well.
Last day of the season.
With the money they're spending, should they not be winning this league at a can? Is it acceptable that they're getting battered at home, you know, once a month by teams with the money they're spending? They're spending a lot of money, man.
Well,
I should be clear by now, surely.
I've never really gone by the price tags. I go by what's on the pitch, because ultimately, I've seen it over Chelsea over the last 10 years. Sometimes we've spent so much money, and I've looked on what we've actually got in the squad, and I thought, well, these guys are just hard workers or runaround guys. These guys are not real. You know, sometimes being a City or a Chelsea or other teams in Russia, you actually overpay due to your reputation. So I don't really go by just the actual fee itself, but I go by looking at their squad player for player, talent-wise. I don't think there are too many squads in Premiership history who could say, talent-wise, they'd be that much better than City's squad. And I think they have underachieved. They've underachieved in Europe. They've underachieved in the league. Like you said, if Gerrard didn't slip, or if Aguero didn't in the last minute.
It's the post.
When they have, then they might not have won a league. But for me, it comes back, and I don't want to seem like I'm bashing, but I think what they've done is got managers who are probably not as good as their squad. So for me, Mancini wasn't up to the level that Man City needed. And I'd say the same thing about Pellegrini as well.
So you're on that point, okay, Pellegrini's lack of quality as a top-level manager can't be blamed for company being injured, can't be blamed for Yaya being lazy, that can't be blamed for Silva being out injured. That's not a reflection on his ability as a manager. Jose Mourinho was there, no company's there, that team still probably would struggle, because company seems to be their rock.
Personally, I think, I mean, it's difficult to argue it based on this season's form, but I think other managers, such as Jose Mourinho, such as Jurgen Klopp, get more out of players of lower quality. I mean, if you look at Chelsea's team, the first team that won the league, we had a few players of really high quality, but then we had people like, you know, Alexis Smertin and Yuri Yarasek.
Let's all agree it was Ranieri's team, though. Let's all agree.
No. I'm not having that. Not having that in a million years. Ranieri did start the foundation, yes, but it wasn't Ranieri's team.
If you ain't got concrete underneath your house, it's going to fall down, isn't it?
Yeah. No, I'd agree. Don't get me wrong.
To be fair, isn't Roman the concrete then? Isn't Roman doing the foundation?
No, he's the person paying for the concrete to make sure you get top-level concrete.
Well, I mean, bear in mind, Ranieri was there the year before, and he had the concrete, he had the cement, he had the bricks, he had the water, and he never came close to winning the league. So he had all the tools there, and I like the guy, but he wasn't a perennial winner. No. Jose was, and that's why I think it made the difference.
Tasha, does anybody embody and sum up Manchester City more so than Yaya Toure? Because when Yaya Toure is not on it and he doesn't fancy it, he's shocking and he just gets overrun. He just looks lost and disinterested. When he is on it and he feels like playing, you can't beat that team. Does he embody the problems that City have got? When they feel like it, they're unbeatable. But when they're not in the mood, they will get tucked in 4-1 at home.
Not so much, because I think we were talking about Mancini before. Mancini built the team around Yaya. Yaya is one of those sort of players. For all his faults, we all love him. When he's on form, he's just ruling the pitch. Like, you know, we all love him. Man United fans, whatever. Man City fans, Arsenal. But if it's a team that doesn't suit him, he's not working hard for you because he doesn't feel you're working hard for him. I think there's a bit of stick and carrot there. I don't think Pellegrini's really learned how to get the best out of him. Whereas Mancini is very much an arm around a shoulder kind of manager. I think Pellegrini's more of a someone go and tell him what I want him to do kind of manager.
Does he have to, when Silva's fit, does he have to be dropped? There's a, and it would be a big call, but we clearly now see, everyone can see upon Pellegrini, he can't play in a two. Fernandinho and Fernando seem to be the more suited to that kind of dogged role, and Silva's obviously a better number 10. So a big call it would be, but does he have to get dropped from that team once Silva's back fit?
It depends.
You play Silva and Yaya, basically.
It depends who else is injured, doesn't it?
If they're all fit.
Yeah, I'd take Silva all day long. I love Yaya, but there's no consistency to his game. I always feel like Silva's one of them players, he always gives his all. Like Santi Cazorla, even when he's bad, he's good. So I feel like, yeah, I'd play Silva.
The team functions better without Toure.
You think?
The big loss to City are when Kompany doesn't play.
That was Aguero, my final point to you, actually.
And when Aguero doesn't start, and Silva. That's the spine of City.
Who was the most important person in that team? Or who's the biggest loss of those three?
Kompany's the biggest loss.
I was going to say, so when
City don't lose very often when Kompany plays. Mm. They win more when Aguero starts up front,
and
then
Joe
he gets
Hart
goals.
Doesn't concede as often when Kompany plays.
Yeah. Yeah.
Them two have a really good understanding. I think you can see the way Hart's very vocal, and the way he shouts at the defenders when Kompany's not on the pitch, because he has to, because Kompany's not there to do that for him.
So do they have to look at Kompany and treat Kompany almost in the kind of Jack Wiltshire, Phil Jones, Daniel Sturridge kind of bracket, because he's clearly got something perennially wrong with him. He's a quality defender, but when he's not there, he's missing like a third of the season.
Yeah,
every
you've got to wrap him up in cotton wool. Mm. I'd wheel him out for the big games. There's games
would
City
you manage
will,
his games now?
I'd manage his games. There's games City will win without Vincent Kompany, just like there's games they'll win without Sergio Aguero. But Liverpool is not one of them. As we're seeing, United, your Arsenals, they're tough games, they're big games. You want your best players, no matter who they are, to be playing in those games. He also might have to manage, it's one for Kompany, he might have to manage his international football. I thought he was quite disrespectful to City to go and play international football when he hadn't played for 6 weeks leading up to those games. And I'm someone who likes international, I'm not saying that international football should be denigrated in any way, but if you haven't played any club football to then go and play 90 minutes, I don't know, maybe you should be thinking a little bit about the people who are paying your wages.
Shane Long also played after not having played for Southampton, hadn't even trained.
That's Ireland, we've got no one else.
Jesus,
Belgium are number one ranked side in the world.
I think that's why Kompany wants to play, because he's very much like, if Ryan Giggs was about now, he's been in his international team where he's seen the crap, he's seen the rubbish, and now hold
the
on a second, we're
here.
Good and I'm gonna enjoy it. I don't care if my leg's hanging off, I'm gonna be on the pitch and help these youngsters. And I think
I understand there's national pride comes into it, but I'm not saying or any of the big games, but there's got to be the odd friendly maybe where he goes, do you know what?
Yeah,
I'm a 45 minute man here. I've got to think about my body because I can't play two games in a week.
Yeah. All right. Cool. Nice one, guys. Gabriel, who's the better centre back? Mertesacker, Mangala, Lovren.
I'm like saying, do you want me to stab you or do you want me to shoot you?
That's a dummy list.
I'll set you on fire.
All right, okay, no, you're right. Let's reverse that. Who's the worst of the three? That's probably the better question, isn't it?
Mangala, Lovren, or
Mertesacker.
I'm gonna go with Mertesacker, just because I think Mertesacker has been established. He's played in World Cups and he's played. You know, he's got experience.
He's won World Cups.
He's won World Cups. Yeah, exactly. But he still turns in awful performances all the time, where I think Mangala has the chance to improve. And I think he still might come good because he's got the raw attributes. And also, Lovren looked really good at Southampton. I don't know what your boys have done to him, but he looked really good at Southampton.
That was the best he played on Saturday. I don't know what Klopp's done to everyone, but even Lovren looked like a centre-back for 90 minutes.
Who's the worst of three for you?
Currently, I'd say Mangala. But I agree with Gabriel. I think he might turn into a good centre-back. He's got all the attributes to be a decent centre-back. It looks like he just needs coaching on where he needs to be on a football pitch and a bit of communication. Maybe playing alongside Kompany would be good for him. But currently, I'd say Mangala.
Natasha?
Lovren.
Controversial.
Not that controversial.
I say that because I was always more of a fan of Jose Font. and I think anyone can look really good next to a really good player. I don't think he doesn't seem to learn. I think Per gets a bye because he's old and he's won a World Cup and he likes a bit of bashment, so that's why he's getting a bye. But yeah, Mangala, I think, yeah, I agree with the guys. I think he's young. It's about education for him right now. It's about learning the game and understanding where you need to be. Like when you hear Kara and Genev talk about where defenders need to be, I think that's what it's about for him now. But I don't think Lovren is that good. And bearing in mind, this is the same club that spent $35 million on Andy Carroll. So I'm always going to doubt any purchase they make, whether it's a pack of crisps or a football player.
Wow.
I spoke a lot about City's transfer dealings. Ours haven't been great, to be fair.
Quite a good point. All right, let's move on to our next topic now. Start with you, Tasha. With the recent, obviously, terror attacks that have happened in Paris a week or so ago, has it made you think twice about going to the Euros? And if I gave you two tickets to a final between France and Germany, would you go?
Yeah, I'd take my mum.
So you don't have any doubts or qualms about going to any high-profile football game in France?
It's not that I don't have any doubts or qualms, but I've always kind of been of the mentality that I could walk across the road to go to the paper shop and get hit by a bus. I could be on a train and it could crash. I could fall asleep and there could be carbon monoxide in my house. What I mean is things are going to happen. Life is life. And I would rather not live my life in fear. And I think that's a personal choice. I understand why some people don't. I went to the England game on Tuesday. I was chatting to one of the press guys and he said 100 people asked for their money back, but 10,000 people bought tickets after the events in France. And I love the fact that there's so many people out there that were like, do you know what, we know crap stuff, well, murders, terrorism happens, but do you know what we're saying to you? We're saying, I'm sorry, I'm going to swear, but fuck you. We need to do what we need to do. We still need to live our life, because if we allow you to scare us, then we'll never leave the house. In the same way we had 9/11 and people stopped going on planes. I just think if you... Don't get me wrong, I was following the news and I found it... I don't even know the words to say how I found it, but I refuse to let them stop me doing the things that I would normally do, and going to the football is something I would normally do.
Okay. I think Natasha will probably be in the majority of people that love their football, and especially for a high profile sporting tournament, won't let the terror attacks and the threat of terror attacks put them off going to see their sport of their choice. And the narrative that you can't let the terrorists win and stop you living your life is a completely plausible and probably the correct mentality to have. But this is a country that have had three attacks in the last year, I think. Two very high-profile attacks in the last year. There was an attack outside the stadium where the final will be held. It's going to more than likely be two high-profile footballing nations, a France, a Belgium, a Germany, a Spain. They're going to be there. The world media is going to be on that game. There's going to be 80,000 people in that stadium. Is that not a terrorist hotspot? And would it put you off going if I gave you two tickets to go?
Well, no, I follow the Republic of Ireland, so we don't qualify for tournaments very often, Jordan. So when they come about and they're only in Paris then, or in France, then there's going to be a huge Irish crowd travelling over to that tournament. But look, it probably is going to be a target, or it's something that people that are that way inclined are going to think about. It's an event that there's going to be a big gathering of people. It's something that will weigh on people's minds. But I agree with Natasha, I guess. You can't let people win in that case. You've got to carry on doing the things that we love and show that the things that we care about and the things we take that we love in our lives, that we're not going to be cowed by what's going on, and we're not going to bow down to that kind of threat, and we'll go and enjoy our football, and we'll go and enjoy a few drinks after a game, or people will enjoy a fan park. But I think, yeah, like you said, we'll be foolish to think that there will not be people that won't go to France because of what's happened. There will be people that won't attend, and there will be people that you would offer your two tickets to that would turn it down. And I don't think you can think anything less of those people, because it is kind of scary right now.
And you, sorry to interrupt, you said about the 80,000 people in the stadium. Clapham Junction, I think, is the busiest London's train station. What is it, 150,000 people every day? That's a terrorist threat.
The world's media aren't on Clapham Junction train station.
No, but my point is, you know, the world we live in now, I hate to say it, but pretty much every breath you take is a terror. If you go anywhere that's public, that's well known, that's famous, that has a pedigree of a concert hall or a football stadium, I think it's awful that people go to do something they enjoy and not come home. But everything is a terror threat these days. I think, you know, I understand why people won't go, but me personally, I would.
Gee, there's an argument to suggest that what happened, obviously, in Paris was very tragic. But there's an argument to suggest that the one success of that tragedy was the fact that the guy didn't get into the stadium. So you could argue that the football stadiums right now are the safest places to be.
Yeah.
Because, you know, he didn't get in. He tried to get in. He didn't get in because it was the threat was thwarted. So, you know, has it put you off at all going to any football games? And would you go to France next year?
No, not at all. I mean, first thing, because I'm not a Graham Lasso. So, so where the football is,
I was on the Jose bandwagon.
And second thing, I think in terms of some of my, and call me sad if you want, or maybe that's why you've brought me onto the show, some of my best experiences have been at live football events or live events in general. No one's going to take that away from me. I'd rather have those experiences. Honestly, I mean, and you know, if something happened, I'd at least know that I'd went there doing something that I loved and I enjoyed. And, you know, and as Natasha said before, something can happen anywhere. I work in central London. You know, that the thought of a terrorism attack is something I have to deal with almost on a daily basis, but I don't let it stop me from doing what I do.
Would you take your two kids if you had two kids? I give you three tickets.
You did make me pause. Obviously, obviously, I'd have to consult with the wife first, see how she felt, and obviously consult with the kids, because they'd be aware of what happens in the world.
The kids want to go and the wife's cool with it.
Because I do think that's relevant.
4 and 10.
I'd take the 10-year-old and not the 4-year-old. The 4-year-old wouldn't understand.
What if the 4-year-old wants to go to that final more than anything in the world? I'm giving you three tickets to go to a final between Spain and Germany.
We sit down as a family and we discuss it.
The mum's cool with it, in your case, the dad's cool with it, and the kids really want to go.
Just to clarify, I am the mum in this situation. I'm definitely not the dad.
You might be both.
I have certificates to prove it. No, I have certificates to prove this.
Because that's the next thing. I mean, we're all, you know, none of us here have got kids, so we could all... Do you have kids, Stephen? Okay.
No kids.
So it's
that I know of.
Okay.
No,
yeah, you go. So it's a very kind of central, selfish even decision that we can make, that I love football. They're not going to ruin my love for football. I'm going. But if you've got kids and they really want to go, I've given you three tickets to the final, would you go?
I think I would, because I'm that kind of, I'm not going to let the buggers get me down. I'm not going to let the buggers stop me. And God forbid, if anything happens, if I go, I'd rather go being happy with the way I'm living my life than be miserable because I didn't do something. And then I got, you know, with the greatest respect to all the people that passed, and I know we all think that, and you know, we've all seen the coverage, and it's horrible to see their family and the feelings they must have. But I think if you feel you're strong enough to go and do something like that, then you should go, because I think we have opportunities that a lot of people don't. We have a day-to-day freedom that a lot of countries don't. So to us, going to a football game is a big thing. To them, just having water and food is a big thing.
Okay.
When you weigh it up, it's not really that big.
I think you've also got to trust that the people put in the UEFA French authorities, that those guys know what they're doing, and that people's welfare and their safekeeping is paramount when you set that tournament up. So you've got to slightly rely and trust that those things are going to be put in place, and there's a less of a chance of those kind of things happening at that event.
So that leads to my next question. If there was a heightened terror threat a month before the tournament, would that put you off going?
It's a month before, so I'd probably want to know what the terror threat was around the couple of days I was planning to go.
They thwarted a terrorist a month before. They found him. He's gonna do it a month before. They found him. They got him. They stopped it. But the tournament's gonna still go ahead.
well, then they've done their job. So yeah. I trust, like I was saying, you trust in the security services that they are doing their job. And if they've stopped him and it's out there that they've stopped someone from performing an attack,
you trust
then,
that it works.
Then I would trust that, okay. that it's a safe place. I would question possibly, the one thing I would question was if on the day of a game, Paris was like Brussels is right now.
Okay.
Where they're saying it's a state of emergency, and
that's what people, I'm going to.
I think that's a different case. They're basically saying the city is not safe.
Right. I'm trying to push the three of you to find out what it would take for you to.
But I would expect in those circumstances, if that was the case, and they've raised a threat level to that degree, that the game would be called off anyway. Yeah. So, and then hopefully when things are safer, then I would attend.
Okay. They played the La Marseillaise ahead of all the Premier League games. The weekend just gone. Many fans didn't think it was quite necessary. But when you go to football games now, are you quite happy, start with UG, with the level of security that you're now seeing? It's a necessity for obvious reasons. But you're going to a game now to enjoy your couple of hours that were, in your case, not be much enjoyment when you go to football games, but generally enjoy your football with your friends. Yeah. Do you feel comfortable or do you feel uncomfortable with seeing armed guards outside Stamford Bridge? Does that make you feel comfortable that, we're safe, or does it make you feel like, actually, this is dampening the enjoyment?
I've never seen any armed guards, if I'm honest, but I think going to football games or going to Stamford Bridge and going to Wembley, one thing that I do find the security can be a bit over the top. Although I understand why they're doing it, so I don't complain, you kind of get on with it. But I don't like that they're thoroughly going through my bag, no matter how big or small it is. Like, some, I try to bring a smaller bag. You're not going to get a bomb in here. But, you know, they go through it. They look through your stuff. I mean, sometimes I go to football coming straight from the gym. I'm like, guys, you really don't want to look through my stuff if I just go from the gym. but that's what they do. I do find that a bit annoying. Also, it's particularly at Wembley, they do random bag searches, and I say random with inverted commas, because the random, I mean, I go with one of my friends and I've been stopped every time and he gets through every time, so it makes me wonder how random it actually is. In terms of that, it's annoying. I wouldn't feel that it hampers on my fun, because at the end of the day, once I'm in the ground, I could be sitting around with 20 guys with armed rifles. The football's on, I'm watching, I'm zoned out. That's the most important thing for me.
Okay. Going back just briefly to the England-France game, do you think it was correct to continue with the game? Bearing in mind it was only days after the attack in France. France were in England. England's another area you'd assume is for the terrorists are trying to do. It was a friendly. Do you think it was the right decision to continue with that game? I mean, in hindsight, it was a great game, nothing happened. But do you think it was a mistake continuing with that game? It could have been just scrapped.
Look, I think in the grand scheme of things, I think it's quite good to actually get the game on to show, do you know what? You can do what you want in Paris. It's disgraceful what's happened, terrible scenes. But you're not going to stop our way of life. And 80,000 people are going to come out and they're going to go and watch a game of football. And it's a kind of a token message to the terrorists. This is us. This is what we are. And it was a sign of respect as well for France. I thought the FA actually done a really good job on for that game. They got it right. They got the tone right. The crowd was fantastic. The only thing I would question about that game is my understanding was the French players were not consulted before it was agreed to go and play that game. The French FA kind of had it all signed and sealed. I would question that. I think some of the French players looked slightly
completely
off the place in
agree.
That game. And Sanya was still saying, going back to the City game, maybe another part of the reason why they were so poor. Himself and Mangala were in the Stade de France when that took place. That's got to be hard to get over. And
I completely agree. I think the game should have gone ahead, but I didn't like the fact that the French players hadn't been consulted. I mean, you saw Koscielny there wiping away tears during the national anthem. I think I've heard a lot of moment silence, minute silence in stadiums. I've never had one where the hairs on your goosebumps are just up. It was silent. You know, there's always that one twat that wants to shout because he's drunk. There was none of that. It was perfectly honoured. And I think, you know, as an English football fan, I was proud. There was English fans walking up to the stadium with their French flags. And although it was very somber, there was a kind of camaraderie that you wouldn't normally get between those two nations. I think, yeah, the England team, the FA, the players all stood together. It all set a tone. And you know what? When it comes down to it, football is just a game. And life is more important. But if we can use football to make people smile or enjoy a bit of their life, then that's kind of what it's about, isn't it? Yeah.
I'll tell you one thing, Jordan. I think what the FA did and what the football clubs did over the weekend was really good in terms of what happened in Paris. But I think in the same week, we had a lot of other...
My final point was going to be they're going to do that every week for every nation that gets attacked or has something bad happen to them.
Well, I think they really need to look at, you know, just doing it just for one country. And don't get me wrong, I'm not against them doing it for one country at all. But it seems as if it kind of gives the impression, and not to get too dramatic about it, but almost like certain lives are more important than others. And I think maybe they should have thought about that a bit more rather than just having things for Paris. There was, you know, quite those incidents in Nigeria. There were incidents, about 3 or 4 incidents, I know, within that space of time. Beirut. So, you know, they could have thought a bit broader. And that's the only one criticism I would have.
Finally, guys, I want to talk on the FFP this week about Leicester City, off top of the league. I think they deserve a little bit of love, a bit of attention, because it won't last very long, to be honest. So let's give it to them while they're at the top. But I want to talk about Jamie Vardy, because everyone's done that to death, and I'm bored of Jamie Vardy now. What I want to know from you guys is, start with you, Stephen. Is there more to Leicester City than Jamie Vardy? Because I've got the back four of Simpson, Morgan, Huth and Fouque, they pronounce it. With Schlupp, who comes at wing-back sometimes. They've got this boy Kante in the middle, who my Leicester fans tell me he's been really, after Vardy and Mahrez, the best player, if not as equal to those, importance to those players. And Danny Drinkwater as well. Is there more to this team than just Vardy and Mahrez banging goals? Do they have a good defence, or is it just a really, really good couple of months?
Well, I think they can thank an ex-Chelsea manager considerably for what's going on at Leicester at the moment. I mean, it's not much of a difference from the side that was there last season, yet the style of play and the results are vastly improved on last season. So I think you can thank Ranieri as a first and foremost.
Why? What's he done?
I thought he was treated with massive disrespect when he got that job. The title of Tinker Man has followed him round. And I think the problem with that was he was probably 10 years before his time in this country, where, I mean, now most managers, you very rarely see a team start with the same starting lineup as they started in the previous
Pep
game.
Guardiola's changed his team 49 times in a row, I read.
Benitez, when he was the Liverpool manager, in the 4 years he was there, never picked the same starting 11. But because he was kind of at the vanguard of that, it was unusual to English football. If you've settled on your best 11 and they win the previous week, why would you go and change? He picked up the nickname Tinker Man, and I think that kind of has followed him around, and we forget that he's managed Juventus and he's managed Roma, he's finished second in Serie A and he's won Coppa Italia's. So it was a surprise. He's had one real failure in his career, was managing Greece. Other than that, he's got something like, I seen the other day, he's got a 47-48% win ratio in his career at some big clubs in big leagues across the world. So to me, that was a coup, Leicester City getting him as a manager.
And then Do you think he'd be the first to go when he was appointed? Do you think it was a bad... Because we can all say that in hindsight now, but maybe you did.
I didn't think he'd be the first to go. I thought, if I'm honest, another an error in judgment was I thought Bilic should be in trouble at West Ham. I weren't entirely sure of that appointment. I knew Rodgers was going to be in trouble at Liverpool, so I didn't think Ranieri would be in trouble. I thought he had a decent squad, add a couple of players to it and they'd be all right. And then when you look at it, Mahrez was arguably for 3 or 4 months of last season was fantastic player. He's started off on fire again this season. Kante's looked a decent signing. Huth's a solid centre-back. And you've got a really good goalkeeper. So as a spine of a side, Leicester are pretty well set up. And then he's getting that little bit extra out of the so-called lesser players, your Drinkwaters, your Mark Albrightons. all looks good for Leicester, but a lot more to them than Jamie Vardy, I'd say.
If the wheels fall off at Leicester, because they will have a bad patch at some point and they won't finish top four, but if the wheels fall off at that team, do you think Ranieri is the man to get them back on track, or is it a case of they're on fire right now, but when it really goes wrong, it's really, really going to go wrong? Is there a team there that can still grind out results if Vardy goes for a 2-12 patch at any point in the season?
Yeah, I think overall the team is still good enough. I think even if you look at what Nigel Pearson did and you look at the results they got towards the end of last season, like, it was championship winning, it was, you know, Premier League winning form, you know. I think they won like 7 out of the last 9 or something like that.
I think they'd be top since be the top. 22nd yeah. of April.
Calendar year. Yeah. Games calendar year, they would have won the league if it was a calendar year situation.
Yeah. And one of the games they lost was to us on our way to the title. So that kind of, that gives you
some business. I think it's only Arsenal this year and Chelsea last year. Yeah. They've lost this calendar year.
Yeah. I think it is. But I also want to continue the theme of, because I did mention Nigel Pearson, but now I want to shoo him away, because when I think there is kind of like a group of English managers who I think are slightly bitter because they don't get the top jobs, and they always protect English managers when a new foreign manager comes in. And I'm putting Allardyce in there, I'm putting Pulis, and the first thing they say when you ask them a question about how well Leicester's done is, oh, well, Pearson set the foundations. All Ranieri had to do was come in and it was going to be great. Ranieri's obviously has improved that team. And can he get the best out of players?
They wouldn't be top with Pearson in charge, would they?
No, absolutely not. They might still be in a relegation zone, you know. And can Ranieri improve them as players, and can he keep the team going? Yes, I think he can, because first thing, it probably doesn't mean much in football, but he's a gentleman from what I know of him, and from what people who speak about him, like Lampard and a lot of ex-players will say, he's a really good guy. And he's managed really...
Is that important? Sorry to cut you there. Is that important? I'm not saying it's not, but I'm asking, is it important as a manager is a gentleman?
I think it's a unique quality that will mean that he might be able to get things out of players that other managers can't. And I think he's managed really top-class players all across the world, and I can only imagine that the Leicester players would respect that and buy into what he said. And really, going back to what you said about being a tinker man, you know, 10 years ahead of his time, it goes back to like this English mentality that we have, that we always know what's best. You know, it's got to be 4-4-2. You know, everyone else changes it 5 years in advance. It's got, you know, you've got to play a first 11. Everyone changes it first
ahead of his time. We've got an introverted way of looking at world football. You regularly hear the best league in the world, the best player, or we're always talking about, is this guy, can he be the best player in the world? We've got to have the best of everything, and we're very shut off to what's going on. And when the Juventus turn up and beat Man City, like, it comes as a shock.
Yeah, or when we get to the World Cup and we get battered, or we struggle to get at the group stages, and people just don't understand it.
They're shocked when a good manager like Ranieri comes along and takes over Leicester City and improves on what was there previously.
Tasha, how high can they finish?
I think,
what's their ceiling?
If I would say 10th is their ceiling. I would say, let's be realistic in that there's a lot of players there who are overachieving in terms of their basic level of talent. And given that last year they were fighting relegation, I think every Leicester fan in the country would, in the world actually, would take 10th place now and literally bite my hand off. But I feel like they're going to have their dip. Right now they're on the crest of a wave and every other cliche you can think of. But they're going to have a dip at some point, and there is at least 9 teams that are individually and as teams better than them.
So one of the things that I keep hearing from people is, well, from Ranieri, which I really liked about a month or two ago, and he does an interview. He keeps them level head. He talks about 40 points. He said, look, we're on fire, we're doing really, really well, but let's get to 40 points and then we take it from there. I like that. He's not getting caught up in the hype. But is there not a flip fear of that then when they get to 40 points, they clock off?
No, because it's... Do you know what it is?
Do you know
what
I mean,
Steve? I've heard a story about Middlesbrough under Steve McLaren throwing a party when they hit 40 points
See that. I think Ranieri is very much... You know what? You know when you have a teacher you don't like? and you don't put the effort in, but then you get a teacher you like, and that teacher understands that you struggle with that subject, so they encourage you. That's the difference between Pearson and Ranieri. I feel like it's the carrot and the stick. Like, even Ranieri, you keep a clean sheet, everyone gets pizzas. Stuck to his way. It sounds so simple, but it's about making the players feel like it's down to them. Whereas Pearson was me, arguing with people in press conferences. Ranieri's all about, it's the team, Vardy, Mahrez. He's making it all about them and the fans. And I think the respect, like you were saying, like Gabrielle was saying, the respect the players will have for him means that they will give their all until that last minute or that last whistle of the season. I don't see them dropping off, because they'll be like, we've hit 40 points. How high can we go? Let's show everyone we're not just a flash in the pan. Although I don't expect him to be there at the end of next season. But yeah, I still think 10th is probably the highest they can...
You can't see them top 10 next season?
No.
Why not?
Because I think this season's probably a bit of an anomaly. And with the new TV money, everyone will strengthen. And with the greatest respect to Leicester, they're not in an attractive or as an attractive location as some other clubs.
So, Stephen, as well as Pearson going and Ranieri coming in, people seem to forget that they lost Cambiasso as well. And people were saying that was a big element of why they did so well last year, and they needed to keep him. No one's chatting about him. So, going back to what Natasha's saying there, clearly he has had an impact in terms of keeping that team spirit important and squeezing the maximum out of all of those players who aren't top players, but he's getting the best out of them.
No, but exactly that. I couldn't agree more with Natasha on that. I mean, if you take a player like Mark Albrighton, was bombed out of Aston Villa 3 years ago, wasn't good enough to play there. They had better youth talent coming through. Look where Aston Villa are now, and look what Mark Albrighton's doing in the league. Mm. He scored 3 or 4 goals this season, 4 or 5 assists. I think Cambiasso as well, going back to your point on Cambiasso, Cambiasso's coming towards the end of his career. They've bought a younger, fitter Cambiasso, effectively, in Kante. Someone who can do pretty much, maybe not as good as Cambiasso in his heyday, in his prime.
But
good enough for Premier League, for what they require of him in the Premier League this season. He's been a very, very astute signing. And again, that comes back to Ranieri. He's picked up them little gems that maybe someone else has overlooked. He's gone and got him, and he's fitted in perfectly into that team.
I think as well, there's quite a few players at Leicester with a point to prove. You know, Danny Drinkwater was part of the Man U setup. Danny Simpson, we all know the issues he's had. Huth would have felt a bit hard done by after being at Stoke for so long. So I feel like there's a few players there who are all like kind of, he's making them believe in themselves, not believe in the hype, but believe in themselves. You're good enough. And I think if you tell someone they're good enough for long enough, they'll believe it. And then that transpires onto the pitch, which is why they, when they're 2-0 down, they don't stop playing.
Mm.
And they will come back and win 3-2.
Well, I think the other thing that's maybe been to Leicester's advantage this season is it's their second season in the Premiership. Where's Morgan at centre-back? Early on in the league last season, he looked way out of his depth. He didn't look a Premier League centre back. He looked awkward, caught out of position quite a lot. This season, that's a solid centre back partnership they've got going on. So he's grown into the league. He's learned who he's up against. He's adjusted to the pace of the league, as have a lot of the other players that are involved in that side. So there's a whole range of things that I think have fed into Leicester, their season so far.
Gee, just for final point now, I mean, they've got Man United on the weekend. Something else that you could argue has gone in their favour is their fixtures. I think apart from Arsenal, they've not played any of the other top teams yet. So we're going to find out how good they are in the next month or so. I think they've got City, United, I think Liverpool, I think they've got you lot as well.
Before we've got them as well.
In a way, it doesn't matter though, because they wouldn't... they're the top six. You don't count those points. You think you're lucky to get, if you get a point off each six games,
so it's still part of that, just get as many points as you can before the bad days come.
But to them, they weren't, when they were counting their 40 points, they weren't looking at getting points off Arsenal, off Man U, off City. So to them, this is Christmas. This is like, yeah, I'm going to go out and see what I can do. If we get a point, great. If not, we're cool.
Can you see them causing the big teams problems, or are they top because they've just been literally swatting away the teams from 10th downwards?
No, I think that
are you
that
worried about them?
I've got to worry about everybody at the moment.
No, it was a struggle the weekend, wasn't it? No.
But I think their game against Man United on the weekend will be a really good game. I think Natasha makes a great point in that the players are playing above themselves. But when you are playing above yourself like that, you can believe you can achieve things. So they can believe that they can beat Man United. And I think that will be key for them over the weekend. So yeah, I think it'll be a good game. And I think they might cause some of the big teams some problems.
They're going to force United to attack, which I think is going to be really interesting. Mm. You know,
they don't like that.
Yeah, because you're looking at Leicester now and they are feeling like an Arsenal team. They're going to score goals. Mm. You know, they're getting chances. They're putting them away. Mm. Whether it's Vardy, whether it's Mahrez, you know, there's players on that team that can score.
Is there enough goals in that team to carry on the form of the team if Vardy stops scoring?
Yeah, we're already a third of the way through the league and they're top of the table.
With Vardy on fire. Yeah. He won't be on fire for the whole
season. Yeah, sure, was worth a couple of goals in that side as well.
You know, Mahrez, I think it's maybe five goals and eight assists or something ridiculous. Which is a good... I think it's him, Ozil, and I can't remember who the other player is. And that's the top three in the league. He's up there with a World Cup winner. So there are players capable in that team. Yeah.
Okay. All right, guys. Thank you very much for joining me on the FFP this week. Just another reminder to subscribe to us via the iTunes library. Click that lovely subscribe button, Football Fans Podcast as well. We will catch you all next week. Peace.